All right. Hello, everyone. Thank you for packing the room. No pressure. As Peter mentioned, I'm Kevin Fleming. I've actually spoken at FOSDEM quite a few times before, but never in the DNS room. So this was a bit of a stretch to think that I might even get a talk accepted here. And I'm thankful both that the team did and that you all decided to show up. So as he mentioned, I don't know if I'd call it a mistake. I made a decision a few years ago about something that I wanted to do differently than I'd been doing, and as a result, I am now running my own public DNS server. So this is done for a personal basis. I don't do this for pay or anything like that. It's the zero profit part. Nobody pays me to do this. In fact, it actually costs money, so it's negative profit, really, if you want to think about it that way. So. Also, this is a bit odd, but I wrote these slides in a somewhat unusual way, where every title of a slide is actually a question from the audience, which I will then answer in the slide. They get somewhat humorous further into the presentation. So if someone in the audience wants to play the role of the person asking the questions as we go to each slide, that would be fantastic. In fact, you could all do it as a group. That would be even more fantastic. So if you decide to do that, that's great. If not, I will be happy to read them.
Really?
Yes, exactly. Yes. So, all right. So start off with everybody in the audience who currently is responsible for running authoritative name servers that are reachable on the public internet, raise your hand and keep your hand up. Okay, all of you. Wow. All right. Now, if you have your hand up, but you're doing that because you run an internet service provider, put your hand down. Okay, all right. So we're down to less than a quarter of the ones who had their hands up originally. That's more than I thought, actually. I didn't think as many people were as strange as I am. So you can see with this up, I already covered most of this anyway. It's relatively easy to do. Obviously, because this is FOSDEM, I wouldn't be talking about it if it required non-free software. It does not require anything that's non-free software. It can be fun for the subset of humanity that would come to a room like this. and it's also not expensive to do. So, all right, now we're ready. We're going to the next slide.
Okay.
Yeah, all right, why would we do something like this? So, the fun part, we already covered. The second part is, for years in my personal infrastructure, I had been using, you're probably all familiar with Hurricane Electric, although they're bigger in the US than they are here for hosting things, but they offered a free DNS hosting service, which I'd been using, was working fine. And then I decided I wanted to sort of enhance my DNS usage and implement DNSSEC for SSHFP records so I could stop having to deal with SSH key distribution issues. And a couple of other things, like I wanted to get real TLS certificates for all of my services. And of course, 5 years ago, Let's Encrypt was just a new thing, and DNS challenges were the best way to do that, and blah, 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 blah. So the things I wanted, the DNS hosting service that I was using did not offer. So I thought, fine, I'll go find a different one. And I can't even remember where it came from, but years ago, some wonderful person on the internet used to maintain a Google spreadsheet of all of the DNS hosting providers, commercial and otherwise, and all these different attributes of what they supported. And so I went to that spreadsheet, and I filtered down to all the ones that had the things that I wanted, and there were three or four left. And none of them were ones I would actually have wanted to use, most of them because the minimum cost was too high. They were designed for, you know, large enterprises that are doing this sort of thing all the time. So I thought, all right, fine, I will consider another alternative.
I'm convinced. What do I need?
All right, what do you need? So, for those of you who have been around on the internet for a much longer time than a lot of the people who I see in the room who aren't old enough for this, if you ever had to fill out the actual paperwork to register a domain name with Network Solutions and fax it to them, you will know what I'm talking about. For those of you who that went way over your head, don't worry about it. So, it used to be a long time ago that this was a really complicated thing to do. Today, it's not such a complicated thing to do. So these are the really simple things you need. You need some place to host the service that's going to be the source of truth for all of your zones. What do they contain? Obviously, you can choose to put that in lots of different places. I choose to put it on a private network that's not reachable from the internet because that's better, more secure that way. You need a few places on the internet where you can make your zones available to the internet. Preferably, those are not all in the same machine, or all on the same network, or all in the same data center, or preferably not even all on the same continent, really. It would be best if they're geographically distributed, if they're not all going to go down because you put them all in the same hosting provider and their control plane breaks all the time, Microsoft, and their entire cloud infrastructure goes down all at once around the world. So keep those things in mind when you decide where to put these things. It's perfectly fine to put these on Raspberry Pis in your friends' houses, if that's something you choose to do. If you have friends geographically distributed around the world who are willing to do that for you, that's fine. But there are plenty of other ways to do it as well. You will, of course, need DNS authoritative server software. There's lots of those out there. There's a bunch of people in this room who are responsible for PowerDNS, so I'm thankful for giving me the chance to do this. And this is actually trickier than you would seem, your domain registrar, the place you host your domains, possibly the also place you bought them from, although they don't have to be the same, needs to let you have the tools to set this up. They need to be able to let you specify your own name servers. Not all of them will. And if you want to do DNSSEC, they have to let you upload DS records for your signing keys for your zones. Fewer of them will do that. Many of them that are, especially the free ones, do not give you the ability to do that.
Is that really enough?
Yeah, that's really it. There's not a whole lot required to do this. Now, this is all written from the point of view of me doing this personally. I would actually be happy to use the same kind of structure if I was doing this for, let's say, a small nonprofit organization or something like that. I would not go in this specific direction if I was responsible for doing this for 10,000 domains for a bunch of people who are paying me to do that. Things would have to be much more complicated in that situation. But now, going back to the way things were decades and decades ago, network solutions time, back then we did not have Google Public DNS, Cloudflare Public DNS, Quad9 Public DNS, massive ISPs with millions and millions or billions of subscribers that ran resolvers on behalf of their clients. So back then, if you wanted to host your own zones, your own authoritative servers, pretty much every small chunk of the internet was going to, if it needed to know an answer for one of your names, it was going to be reaching out to your servers to get it, because there was no caching layer in between them and you. That's no longer true. I mean, obviously, lots of us also run our own resolvers, and so we are going to be part of the noise that's hitting your authoritative servers. But if you have a website that millions and millions of people on mobile phones are going to touch, those mobile carriers, resolvers, are going to go ask your servers for the answers and then hold on to them for however long you've told them they're allowed to hold on to them, a day or 2 days or a week or whatever is appropriate. So you don't really need big, beefy servers to do this. Really, really tiny little machines are perfectly fine for doing this sort of thing. Also, even the smallest machines you can get in clouds nowadays have multi-gigahertz CPUs with very fast RAM. And as I think Stefan pointed out in his last talk, a normal, non-dynamic authoritative server is very fast. It's very predictable. It doesn't take a lot of time to come up with an answer. Usually all the data it needs is in memory already anyway. So these are not, they don't have to be really super powerful machines.
Why did you do this?
Yeah, so I covered some of that already. Actually, I kind of did that backwards, didn't I? I talked about that before I was supposed to. Darn it. A couple of the things that I ran into when I was doing this search was, there was quite a few of the available ones. If you just wanted to host one or two zones, they were okay. The prices were reasonable. I actually considered doing it. At the time, I think I had 7. Now I've probably got 11 or 12 for various different purposes, because we all just grab domain names for projects and then never use them for anything, but you keep them around. So there was a thread on the Fediverse about that. Someone ran a poll. How many domain names do you own that you've never used? The number was high. So there were some where, if you went above 3, it was $100 US dollars a month for the service to be able to do this. There were others who, shockingly, charged by query volume and not by the number of zones. It's like, well, I don't have the control over that. I mean, if someone starts hammering the servers, not paying attention to the TTLs, I don't want my bill to suddenly be $14,000 for this. This is crazy. So fine, we're not going to do that. All right, ready. What do I use today? So, like probably a lot of people at FOSDEM, I have at least one reasonably beefy computer at home, network storage appliance. So there's a container on that where I run the hidden primary authoritative server. Many people who, there was lots of people who will not, will choose not to put things in Amazon Web Services. I'm not going to complain one way or the other. Choose whatever you like. I will say that their ARM-based nano virtual machines are the cheapest machines I could find that were not VPSs, that I could actually install my own software on and open up my own ports and make them available to the internet. There are lots and lots and lots of cloud providers out there, obviously, and if you can do this with a, you know, a one CPU Graviton 2 nano instance, you can certainly do it with a Raspberry Pi or some other small computer like that. If you weren't trying to use PowerDNS, you could probably do it with an ESP32, although I don't think I want to try that, but you could probably do it. So I have three. I have two of those, and then I have a dedicated server in a data center, which I use for offsite backups and running my Mastodon server and Matrix server and all that kind of stuff. I put another one there just because. And it gives me good distribution. One's on the west coast of the U.S., one's on a roughly east coast of North America. It's not in the U.S., it's in Canada. And then one of them is in Europe. So that works out fairly well. So, and then in our home network, because my home network is wildly over-engineered, I have two PC Engines APUs, which are our border devices that connect us to the internet and handle all sorts of things. They're the ones that run the resolvers, the recursive resolvers my wife learned about when she saw the slides. And then, of course, they also have a copy, they also have authoritative servers sitting right next to the resolvers for a reason that I will talk about in a minute. And now you don't have to read this because we're on the same topic. So I use PowerDNS auth server on all of them. I use SQLite databases because they're really simple, and I want to try to keep all of the machines except the primary as stateless as possible and simple to manage and deploy. That also means that I use DNS-based distribution of the data, so it's not like a shared MySQL database or any of that sort of much more complicated thing. But again, since this is why I went back to before, I would not do this if I was doing this for 10,000 zones for paying customers. SQLite 3 would probably not be the best choice. Well, actually, SQLite 3 would probably be okay. AX4 would not be okay in that situation because you'd be doing this constantly, pushing out zone updates. And then, because I use Ansible to manage all of my infrastructure, and since there was no actual good Ansible modules to poke at the PowerDNS API to create zones and manage them and set up TSIG keys, I wrote some, which there's a link to at the end of the presentation.
What does that cost?
Oh, I thought you were asking for the Ansible modules. Yeah, good job, good job. So, excellent. So what does all this cost? So you already got the NAS, putting another container on, it's free, right? Especially for something as lightweight as a primary authoritative server, almost no resources whatsoever. I translated all of the costs I'm paying AWS into Euro for you. You can see that it costs me less than €4 a month to host those machines. Now, that includes paying for them for upfront for 3 years. So because AWS basically cuts the price in half if you do that, as opposed to paying for it on a monthly basis. But it's €78 for 3 years. If you decide 2 years in that you don't want those machines located there anymore and you're basically throwing away €20 of upfront payment, that's not the end of the world. We're not talking about a gigantic amount of money here. And then because I have the rented server in the other data center, putting a server on that was free as well. The software, of course, is all free, and the modules I wrote are also free. So cost is very low. The half of the cost per month is actually the storage cost from AWS for the root volume for the VMs. The actual cost of the VM is less than the storage cost if you do it this way. So, and they won't let you create a root volume that's smaller than 8 gigabytes, even if you don't need that much. That's the small. Well, I'm using the Debian AMI, and it has a hard-coded minimum of at least 8 gigabytes for the root volume. So, I suppose I could make my own and try to cut that down by another few pennies or something like that. So, what do I do with that? So, as I mentioned before briefly, all of the network infrastructure I manage uses real Dutch encrypt certificates for all browser-accessible and actually some non-browser-accessible endpoints. I had been using self-signed certificates previously. For those of you who've done that, you know how painful that can be, having to make sure that everything has the right CA certificate to trust them and everything has, I don't want to do that anymore. It's much easier to use Let's Encrypt for that. Similar thing for SSH. All of there's 25 different SSHable endpoints across this infrastructure. Managing key rotation for them was a pain because then things that had copies of the public half of the key all had to be updated and everything else. Using SSHFP solves that problem entirely, except that it requires DNSSEC. Well, I mean, OpenSSH requires that it be a signed answer for fairly good reasons, so I'm not going to try to work around that. And then something I didn't mention before is doing this not only gives you access to be able to host all of the, you know, standards track RFC DNS records, you probably get to do lots of cool things that aren't actually standards track RFCs yet. So if, for example, HTTPS records, which are still just a draft, and we don't even know if they're really going to end up being approved or not, they probably will. And Firefox and Chrome already know how to use them. I host all of those already for my HTTPS services, because why not? It just took almost no effort to set it up. I do Ansible-based management for all of this stuff, and then I'm sure that most of the open source auth servers out there can do online signing, but PowerDNS auth server certainly can, so I don't have to worry about, you know, regularly re-signing the zones and handling all the key distribution and everything else, because it does all that for me. So the last thing that's mentioned there, which I'll get to just a little bit, but I highlighted it on purpose, how many of you know what catalog zones are? Wow, that's shocking, because it's you wrote the code. Of course, you know what it is. So catalog zones made this whole thing much simpler. In fact, we were joking at dinner last night that there's probably would have had to be three slides in the section about how to do maintenance of all of this that don't have to exist anymore, because catalog zones take care of the whole thing for you. So. I just led right into this, didn't I? So obviously, new software releases have to be deployed. For the moment, although I know Peter's working on it, there aren't currently AR64 packages in the PowerDNS repos. So I use their builder scripts to just build them myself and publish my own packages to my machines to install them. Eventually, I won't have to do that first part, and I'll just run apt-get update, and it'll install the new packages. And then whenever I need to add or remove zones, I go to my Ansible playbooks and I change the list of zones that I want to maintain, go run them, and they poke at the API to do the right things. First of all, make sure those zones now exist or no longer exist on the hidden primary server. And in the past, they also had to reach out to all of the other servers to make the corresponding change. So every secondary had to know that you've added a new zone so that it could know about the data. Catalog zones take care of all of that for me. So now when I stand up a new secondary server, I only have to tell it which catalog zones it's supposed to pay attention to and which server those are supposed to come from. And then it automatically populates its secondary zone list all by itself, and it's automatically updated every time I add or remove zones. It takes, I don't know, a minute maybe for all of them to be updated, and everything is happy. It's really fantastic. So, and there's going to be more cool stuff we're going to do with that in the future. So, So step 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, put them all together. That first one is the most important thing. Go find out what your domain registrar supports. If they don't give you the tools you need to be able to do this, you're going to have to move your domains to a different registrar or give up. Those are obviously two choices, equally valid. But there are lots and lots and lots of really good ones out there in different parts of the world. So it's easy enough to find out. There's a very short list of things you need to be able to do. The biggest things are the DS record is probably going to be the first thing to check. Will they let you upload DS records for your own zones? If they won't, you're dead. You can't do DNSSEC with your zones and that registrar. You have to switch to somebody else. The one I currently use supports both IPv4 and IPv6 glue records, but only IPv4 through the web interface. IPv6 has to be done via support ticket, which is annoying, but it doesn't change very often, so I'm willing to live with that pain. So decide which auth server software you want to use. Obviously, that's going to be an important decision for you. Decide where you want to put all the stuff. Where do you want it to live, both the hidden primary and all the secondaries? And then how are you going to manage the zone list? And as you can see there, if your answers happen to fall in that category, you can do exactly what I did and be on your way. Now, a little bit of bonus here. I did not write, I did write that as a question. I forgot I changed it. So On those network appliances in our home network, I run the recursive resolver for all of the clients on the home network to use to resolve names. And with our last ISP, we had more outages than I would have liked to have. And once you start setting up something like this, you forget the IP addresses for all of your own infrastructure. You only know the names. And when you've made the zone signed and your resolvers can't reach the internet, they can't resolve any of the names because they can't, in my case, my domain is km6g.us, so they have to know what's signed at the root, what's signed at US, what's signed in, you know, all that stuff, right? So we would have very bizarre cases where things inside the network stopped working because our internet link was not working correctly, even though the things we were trying to use didn't use the internet at all. They just couldn't talk to each other because they couldn't resolve names. So now I have the resolvers sitting right with an authoritative server sitting right next to them that hosts all of our zones that nothing talks to except the resolver, so that even if that box can't talk to the internet, it can still resolve any of our internal names with no problems at all. Additional thing there, thank again to the...
Notify from the hidden box.
What's that?
You should use the hidden, the notify from the hidden box.
I am, yeah. Yeah, so what happens here is a feature in the PowerDS recursor, which I will say unabashedly I wrote, which is that you can actually tell the auth server to send notifies to the recursors, which is not something you would think would have ever, I mean, it's not something that's normal. It's really cool, though, because what we do is when that happens, the recursor says, aha, that's a notification from the authoritative server that any content I might have in my cache for that zone is probably stale. I'll throw it all away. So that means if I've got internal infrastructure changes, I've moved a container to a different machine and its IP address has changed, within a minute, everything that needs to use that will get the correct address, as long as it's not running a local cache in on the box itself. So, and then, as I said, over-engineering, I used Anycast and OSPF and all kinds of other stuff to reach the recursive resolver. So there's a bunch of links. The slides are up on the FOSDEM website, so feel free to download them. All of these links are useful, and you can see even the HTTPS thing, which is not even a stent. What's that?
No catalog sounds.
Oh, you're right. I forgot to put that link in there. Tell me where it is, and I'll add it. Yeah. Sure. So. And that's that. And I have 2.5 minutes left. So questions? Yes, sir.
You said you wanted to be required to change DS records. For anyone else want to do this, and please note that some TLDs require you to send up the DNS key record, and they will hash it to DS.
Ah, okay. So he just missed me a comment that depending on which TLD your zones are under, you may have to send a different thing for them, depending on exactly what they want from you. So that's fine. Thank you. Yeah. Don't fight. Yes, that one.
Just another comment. Some TLDs are scanning for CDS, CDNSP, and CC
yes.
records, so you don't have to play with the registrar at all.
Right.
Emerging technology that's been around for a really long time.
Yep, so just... so I had just to repeat that there are some top-level domains not related to the registrar that will actually notice the correct type of records in your zone and pick up the keys from there so that you don't even have to manually update them when you change them or rotate them. Yes. Yes.
You create robust infrastructure, but you still use only one DNS software.
That's a good point. I have diversity and robust infrastructure, but no diversity in the software. That's absolutely a good point. I'm okay with that risk, though. Yes. So how do I ensure that I'm not under attack on the virtual machines, and how do I apply CVE updates? So because of I'm a geek, every Saturday morning before my wife gets up, I run this gigantic Ansible playbook that goes and touches everything and applies all package updates and reboots anything that needs to be rebooted and all of that sort of thing. So I'm reasonably good there. Plus, on the public-facing machines, I have the Debian unattended upgrade thing in place so that if a really important thing gets a package update comes in and gets applied, it will do it for itself. So I don't have to restart that. What was the other question? What was the other part of that one? Oh, the attack thing. Ha ha ha. So this is really cool. Those particular AWS VMs have a hard cap on the amount of CPU that they're allowed to use. So if somebody tries to do a DOS attack on them, they just stop getting responses. So I don't have to do anything. It just, now granted, the resolution of my zones would be harmed by that. But these are personal zones. We're not hitting them all that hard from outside. So that's kind of a neat feature that is just a side effect of the way those particular VMs work, is you're limited in how much CPU you can use. So, yep. And are we out?
Out of time, yeah.
All right.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you all.